welcome to the Gonzaga Socratic Club. This is our last meeting for the fall 2008 semester, so we're glad you're here this afternoon on a quiet afternoon, cold and dark at the end of the semester when many students are not thinking about academic matters. It's good to see you all here. In Dorothy Sayers' mystery, Gaudy Night, published in 1935, amateur sleuth Lord Peter Wimsey remarks, "If it ever occurs to people to value the honor of the mind equally with the honor of the body, we shall get a social revolution of a quite unparalleled sort and very different from the kind that is being made at this moment." As our speaker today will explain to us, Lord Peter Wimsey is talking about scholarly integrity. Scholarly integrity is a particularly appropriate topic for the Gonzaga Socratic Club. The Gonzaga Socratic Club seeks to promote open philosophical inquiry into the Christian worldview, and so to follow the model of scholarly integrity. Indeed, we take as our hero Socrates, who said at one point that his aim was to follow the argument wherever it leads. And it's the objective of the Gonzaga Socratic Club to follow the argument wherever it leads concerning the truth of Christian doctrine and practice. We take our inspiration from the famous Oxford Socratic Club, which was founded at Oxford University in 1941 and presided over by the famous Christian apologist C.S. Lewis from its founding until Lewis's move to Cambridge University in 1954. I wanted to give this background. Many of you have already heard a version of this, but I wanted to give this background because it's become something of a tradition for the Gonzaga Socratic Club in its December meeting to highlight its connection with C.S. Lewis and the Oxford Socratic Club. While Dorothy Sayers was not a member of Lewis's close circle of friends called the Inklings, a group of authors and scholars, her friendship with Lewis and her shared commitment to the life of Christian scholarship has led many to associate Sayers with Lewis, and indeed they were associated as friends. More critically, for our purposes here today, C.S. Lewis was himself a model of the honor of the mind, the topic our speaker will focus on tonight: Christian integrity in scholarship, teaching, and living out the Christian life. And so it's a fitting commemoration of C.S. Lewis to consider this topic here on our Lewis-associated meeting of the Gonzaga Socratic Club here in December. Our speaker today is independent scholar Catherine Bound Koch. She writes, speaks, and researches on topics in Christian typology, biblical studies, Christian art, and the role of women in Christian theology, history, and culture. She published a book in 2002, The Key to the Brescia Casket, Typology and the Early Christian Imagination, that combines a lot of these topics that I mentioned. And indeed, she reported to me today that you found out you have two articles published,
they're on the table in
fresh off the press, so to speak, an additional two articles on topics related to this. So we would welcome our speaker today on the topic of the honor of the mind, scholarly vocation, and intellectual integrity.
Thank you, David. It suddenly occurred to me as you were speaking that, in fact, the quotations that you gave and I'm about to give from Lord Peter Wimsey could be paralleled with the thought of C.S. Lewis, so in that sense that they're very fitting for this association. They fit not only the general aim of the Socratic Club, but the general Christian understanding of what the mind is for. In the novel Gaudy Night, there's a conversation that takes place in the fictitious college, Shrewsbury College, comprised of women scholars, and Lord Peter Wimsey is there, and the topic is honesty and publishing. Wimsey brings up a novel, a recent novel at that time, by C.P. Snow, called The Search, having to do with a breach of honesty in publication. A scientist had published a work and only afterwards realized he'd made a mistake in his research. so what he had published was wrong, and he did nothing to clarify the situation. This leads to a discussion there among the fellows of the college, and the issue comes up, well, this was only accidental. Can that possibly matter? Somebody advances as just a rhetorical question. And Lord Peter Wimsey paraphrases the statement from one of the older fellows in the book by Snow, who says, "The one ethical principle which makes science possible is that the truth shall always be told." The conversation goes on, an example is given of someone who deliberately falsified evidence, and then the general discussion becomes, who would be concerned about that? Now, an interesting point sociologically here is that Dorothy L. Sayers gives to the only member of the faculty who is about to get married. All the others are single. Lord Peter is single at that point. The only one who's about to get married is the one who says, wouldn't a wife, if she found out her husband had advanced his career by publishing dishonest research, feel like a man who's supported by his wife's immoral earnings? And of course, this means, wouldn't she feel like she'd been supported by prostitution, intellectual prostitution on the part of her husband? It's then that Lord Peter Wimsey said, if it ever occurs to people to value the honor of the mind equally with the honor of the body, then indeed we will have a social revolution. And that has been the norm for intellectual endeavor, that the honor of the mind, the following of truth, following the argument wherever it leads, is the sine qua non for scholarship, indeed for a properly lived life, as Socrates would say. But in the last 40, 50 years, it has been acceptable in some academic publishing, which I hesitate to call scholarly publishing. I would like to distinguish between the two. Sometimes things are published that are academic, that are rigorously reasoned, and therefore do not deserve to be called truly scholarly. However, having said that, I'm going to do a sidebar and say, don't mess with that terminology yourself, because it's not, generally speaking, our business to try and pronounce on the intentions of people whose works we're reading, but merely to analyze what they have done and deal with it rigorously in an intellectual way. Logic has to be the basis of argumentation. But what has developed recently, in the last several decades, is that a veneer of reasoning is sometimes acceptable. And you know what a veneer is. I think there's a veneer right here. This is composite. This isn't real wood. But the top of it looks like wood, because that's been applied. But if you take it off, it's composite stuff. It's cheaper. It's not as solid. It's not as durable. It couldn't bear as much weight. That may be wrong. Forget that part of the analogy. I don't think that works. But it's not an honest presentation of what you're getting all the way through. If people really weren't using logic, they'd stop using words like if, then, or therefore, or as a result. They'd stop using documentation in publication, because it wouldn't matter if just saying what you thought was all that mattered. You wouldn't have to argue for anything. So I'm going to go through a number of ways in which there's been a departure from the standard of following the argument wherever it goes in a rigorous way. Interestingly, you can use metaphors drawn from magic to identify these, and it helps make them sort of memorable. And the first is the vanishing footnote. Another one is the smoke of ideology and the mirror of self-projection. And finally, sawing the lady in half, which has to do with nicking around with the evidence. So, what I plan to do this evening is take a number of examples and project them up here with the key parts highlighted so you can see that what's happening physically in the text we're talking about. The vanishing footnote. Basically, footnotes are to give evidence. The broader topic here is inadequate evidence for a point, lack of support for an assertion. That's what I'm referring to generally by vanishing footnote. But in fact, sometimes you actually have footnotes that, if you look at them, lead nowhere or do not lead where they're supposed to lead. I'm going to show you a couple of examples of this. It's probably too small to read. Well, this article, Madeleine Pettit, a French scholar, has a couple of articles. Can we enlarge this? Excellent. A couple of scholarly articles on Tamar from the book of Genesis and on Jewish exegesis of her. And her first one is a very full review of all the extant scholarship about Tamar among the Jews in antiquity. But her next one is the one we'll look at now. And in this article, as you can see, we've got lots and lots of notes here. Half the first page is notes. She's got a double thesis going in this article. And the first... Okay, I highlighted it. In the pseudo-epigraphic literature is sketched a messianic typology for Tamar. Now, no one before had ever said this, that Tamar was a type of Christ. That's a very important point. It's crucial to her argument. She has a footnote number. Now, with vanishing footnotes, the psychological use of footnotes comes into play more than the evidential. If you see a footnote number in a text, you think there's evidence here. Some people don't even bother to read the note because they just think there's evidence here, I don't have to check it out. Or even, I would know enough to verify if it was evidence or not. But let's check it out. This first note simply directs us to an article cited in the first note, which is her own article on the whole Jewish exegetical tradition on Tamar. And her note here says that that divides it into three categories. Now, I assumed when I first read this that meant one whole category treated Tamar as a messianic type. So I got the article, and I read it three times. There's no mention of Tamar as a type of the Messiah. So I read this article again, and on the next page, and you see I've highlighted the bit where she's saying again that these texts have given to Tamar a quality messianic quality. You see just before that, there is a footnote nearby, and you go to the bottom of the page, and here we have a fairly long footnote, all of this down here. At last we have a specific text cited from the Odes to Solomon, a specific one of them, and then you read it carefully, and she says, Song Lian Avek Tamar, without any connection to Tamar. The one text she cites related to the typology of Tamar as a type of the Messiah, she admits in a note, isn't related to her. That's not fair. That's not rigorously reasoned. In fact, what you have throughout the essay, again on the next page, she refers to the messianic traits and character. And near the end, her conclusion refers to Tamar as a messianic figure in Judaism. Notice that this language here, a figure in Judaism, not in a single text, but there's implied to be a whole tradition, but she has not shown one single text that supports this. And suddenly I realized, well, of course, if she had a text like that, that would have been in the body of the essay. That would have been such a huge find. She'd say, this is the name of the text, this is where it's found, here's a quotation from it, and a great detail. If she'd had it, of course she would have made a big play of it. She would have had a responsibility to show us what it is and to demonstrate that it gives that typology. But instead, by the way she's handled it, by her repeated assertion that there was this messianic typology, for a casual reader, she's gotten away with not demonstrating her point. I said this is a two-hypothesis article. The first hypothesis that she never really fully addresses is that there is this tradition, and there is not that tradition. That's what her own evidence indicates. Her second hypothesis is a stinker, because it is that she takes right after she's been assuming that there is this typology. She says, well, how about the New Testament and the Church Fathers? Did they conserve, enrich, or suppress the messianic traits? Then she goes through early Christian exegesis on Tamar, which is very positive. She's a type of the church. And there are various things, and Judah as a type of Christ. This is a very positive typology. She's in the genealogy. Matthew includes her in Matthew's genealogy of Christ. But she sees this, she presents this as if it were a Christian manipulation and suppression of a Jewish tradition that was positive of women. But there was no such tradition. So that's very deceptive. I don't think this could have been published 50 years ago. Maybe make it 70 years ago. I don't think that kind of manipulation, that kind of misleading use of footnotes would have worked. My second example is from a book with a wonderful title, Equally in God's Image, Women in the Middle Ages, edited by this trio of scholars. They make a statement in their introduction about St. Jerome. And to understand this, you need to know the context. St. Jerome was intellectual director for what was in effect the first women's monastery in the West, in Rome. A group of women were organized by Marcella, a widow, all aristocratic, well-educated, and they lived in their own homes, but they would meet together for scriptural study, prayer study, go together to liturgical services. And they asked Jerome to be their director. And he said, learn Hebrew. You already are fluent in Greek and Latin, so you can master the commentaries written by the church fathers. Learn Hebrew. Then you can pray the Psalms in Hebrew the way the Lord did, the way I do too. And that can help you in your own study of Christian exegesis. So a very respectful attitude toward them, and a very rigorous respect for their own abilities. And as you probably know, the major work of Jerome's life was preparing the new edition of the Bible in Latin, most of which he retranslated freshly, directly from the Hebrew. And this took him 30-some years to do. And he would issue it in parts. The books of Kings would come out together, and he'd write a separate introduction to that with some comments about the stylistic work, etc. That's the context in which now hear this statement. It was noble Roman ladies who aided Jerome in his labors of translating Greek and Hebrew scriptures into the Latin of the Vulgate. Now that's a stunning statement if you know the tradition, because that was Jerome who did that. It hasn't been thought that people helped him. So that's a radically new statement. And certainly he was involved with these women, and he dedicates some of his commentaries to various women in this group. But the idea that they assisted him in the translation work is new. But let's look at the footnote, because we do have a note number here. This is the editor's introduction of the book as a whole. And they do cite one of the essays in the book. Jane Bott, The Vulgate Genesis and St. Jerome's Attitude Toward Women. Now, the really good way of citation would be to give us a page number. So we'd know not just the whole article, but one page we go to look for the evidence for this point. But no matter, we go to the article. And we read the article. Jane Barr is a good linguist, and she presents ways that she thinks Jerome was excellent. In some ways, he's particularly sympathetic toward women in his translation in the book of Genesis. And in some ways, he's extraordinarily striking. I'm using her words here. And a couple places, she disagrees with him and thinks that he's done something untoward. One passage, she thinks, is in bad taste. But you can see there's a range of variety of what she's saying he's done in translation. I mention that because it turns out that what the footnote really refers to is not something written by Jane Barr, but it was something written by the same person who wrote that introduction. That person was citing herself, but pretending to cite Jane Barr, which is not appropriate. In the introduction to the subset of the book in which Jane Barr's essay occurs is this statement about Jane Barr. Her essay discusses the accuracy of Jerome's translation of the Vulgate Bible from the Hebrew and Greek into Latin, except where he must inscribe women's sexuality. Thus, the major book of Christianity is seen to have been subverted and betrayed away from women by its male translator. That really is an exaggeration of what Barr's article says and shows. Barr's article gives a mixed review of Jerome and never uses language quite that extreme. Next sentence. Elsewhere, in discussions between Paula, and she was one of those Roman women, and Jerome, we find them squabbling over these inaccuracies. Another footnote now. Long footnote this time. First, a citation of the text at the beginning, and then a statement at the end, which I've highlighted. Jerome, in this letter, is telling Paula's daughter Eustochium, after Paula's death, about the argument he had with her over the translation of the Hebrew zo in Psalm 132. Paula insisting it was her, Mary, Jerome, that it was him, God. One pronoun in one psalm, in one book of the Bible, they have evidence that a woman disagreed with him. They don't even have evidence that Jerome changed his mind on account of this conversation. Let's switch the sexes here. Let's say that a trio of male scholars were writing a book about Christine de Pizan and had evidence that one of the men that she knew had disagreed with her about a pronoun in one of the works she'd written. If those three men had said that that man had assisted Christine de Pizan with all of her writings, wouldn't the scholarly world cry foul? How unfair, how unjust to deprive someone of the intellectual credit for their work because of such a flimsy piece of evidence. So what I call the vanishing footnote sometimes certainly seems to be deceptive, whether or not that's the intent. What has certainly happened here is masking a lack of evidence. After all, it was only one person, too. It was Paula, and it was one Greek text, one Hebrew text. So the exaggeration there was pretty extreme. Now, there are other ways in which people can cite things without actually using footnotes. I'm sure you've often seen parenthetical references in the text. You often find that if you're reading literature, a discussion of Shakespeare, and it will say something like Act 5, Scene 2. No need for a footnote, just put it parenthetical. And you find that sometimes in biblical scholarship where chapter and verse is going to be cited parenthetically. However, that also means you're not being presented with the text afresh. It's being expected that you remember what the text is adequately. But if that's not the case, it's best to go and check it out at least some of the time to check the accuracy of what you're seeing. There is a book by a woman from the Jesus Seminar on women and the historical Jesus in which she makes statements such as Jesus was patriarchal and a product of his time, and that he called all his women followers, including his mother, whores. Now, for those of you who are familiar with scriptures and don't remember Jesus ever calling his mother a whore, be assured your memory is not at fault. It didn't happen. Although Corley cites this twice and only cites chapter and verse of what she is referring to. So I'm going to give you, I keep forgetting I have to show the right side up. I'm going to give you the actual passage. You'll see the word harlots is in here. The context is that the elders of people have said, by what authority are you doing these things? And Jesus counters with, what authority had John the Baptist? And his questioners think, if we say it was from God, he'll say, why didn't you follow him? If we say it wasn't from God, the people will be angry at us. We don't know. That's when Jesus says, amen, I say to you that the publicans and the harlots shall go into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of justice, and you did not believe him. But the publicans and harlots believed him. But you, seeing it, did not even afterwards repent, that you might believe him. And I have down here the pages on which Kathleen Corley cites just verses 31 to 32 and doesn't tell you what the whole passage is. Three points to note here. First, a contextual thing. Publicans, of course, were not just people who collected taxes, but ones who did so in an extortionate way. So this is, what we have here are male and female criminals, extortionists and prostitutes. And of course, Jesus is not talking about his own followers, but those of John the Baptist. And he's praising the repentant publicans and harlots, and seeing them as entering the kingdom of heaven, in contrast to the all-male, if you care about that, elders who are failing to repent and enter the kingdom of heaven. So it's most prejudicial to extract the word harlots from that, or whores, and then generalize and say Jesus was referring to all Christian women, all women followers of him. So you've got to check out sometimes parenthetical references, as well as footnotes. Back 40 years ago, Rudolf Bultmann, in an influential article in which he attacked typology in the Gospels, did something similar. It's not just that he gives actual quotations, but partial ones. And his selection of evidence is very important. He's talking about the New Testament, typology in the New Testament. And he hardly ever talks about the Gospels, and he hardly ever talks about Jesus. He's made quite a fine-tuned selection of what he's using as evidence here. Now, he looks at the passage in John 3:14, which is from Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus. It's actually John 3:13 through 21, a longer passage. And in it, you have the reference to the Son of Man must be lifted up like the serpent in the wilderness. Now, Bultmann says that that's bad typology. With extreme freedom, John 3:14 following takes as reference the Moses-Christ typology. As Moses have lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so will the Son of Man not do any sort of analogous thing, but rather be himself lifted up. And Bultmann similarly takes apart a couple of other New Testament things. But notice what the subject of the sentence is. John 3:14 seems to be the source of the typology. Well, of course, if you read that, the speaker John presents as saying this is Jesus. So if somebody has made a mistake here in how to handle typology, according to John, it's the Lord. According to Rudolf Bultmann, the Lord didn't understand typology well enough to handle it. Or else, he has to deny that this is an accurate representation of what the Lord said, in which case he's got a whole argument that he never even touched in the piece. But he does that throughout. By not citing the whole passage, we don't know, unless we remember, that it was Jesus who said that. And now we get to the most common type of vanishing footnote, which involves no footnote at all. It just involves the way things are said. Just a colloquial example. Do you mind if I use you, David?
Not at all. Go ahead.
David, you should stop beating your dog. Now, presupposed in that are really three statements. That David has a dog. I have no idea.
No, don't have a dog.
That David beats his dog, and if he had one, he wouldn't. Because the focus is on my saying you should stop beating a dog. That's kind of a magic trick, displacement of your focus. The real issue is, does he have a dog and is he beating it? And I've made it an attack on him. That kind of burying statements by shortened ways of expressing them, sort of elliptically slipping them in, is very frequent in scholarship. It can be done magisterially for somebody who really knows the material. It's a very efficient way of getting it in. But for somebody who doesn't know the material or who doesn't want to convey it honestly, it can be problematic. Here's an example from a rather influential book at its time by Marina Warner, a book on the Virgin Mary, Alone of All Her Sex. In an Old Testament figure like Susanna, demure before the aged voyeurs, the fathers saw a forerunner of the Christian virgin. Well, if you break that down and make it into separate statements, we'd say there is an Old Testament figure named Susanna. That's right, there truly is. Now, I'm going to do a little sidebar here just in case some of you aren't fully familiar with that account. Susanna in Daniel 13 is presented to us as an educated woman, beautiful, one who reveres God, married to Joachim. Because her parents, plural, mother and father, were righteous, they had her educated in the law of Moses. That's in the opening to the book of Daniel. At this time, two men were elected elders of the people to judge civil cases for the people, and they would come to Joachim's estate daily to hear the trials. And these men saw Susanna. They turned their eyes from heaven so that they perverted their minds so that they might turn their eyes from heaven and not regard just judgment. That's verse 9. And they looked only at Susanna. And the verb used is a frequentative. They made a habit of looking at her. And they sought a way to find her alone. At that time and in that culture, you could have an enclosed garden that was, in effect, part of your house. It would be like a room, but it was a huge garden. And it was private. And she would go into that area. And they snuck in and hid themselves in there. She sent her maids away to get some things so she could take a bath in the garden and told them to lock the gate. The elders rushed up to her and said, "The gates are locked. No one will see us. We want you. If you do not do what we say, we will tell people you closed the doors to be alone with the lover." Now, that's a death threat, because adultery was punished by stoning to death. They knew it. They were the elders, the judges. She knew it. She was educated in the law of Moses. And her response immediately is to quote King David. I love this. Here's an actual demonstration of her education firsthand. David had been in dire straits at one time, and she paraphrases his whole speech, and she said, "Lo, I am in dire straits. If I do what you say, that is death to me. If I don't do it, I shall not escape out of your hands. But it's better for me, without doing this thing, not to do this, than to fall into the hands. It is better for me to fall into your hands without doing this in the sight of God." Sorry, I blew that. It's a beautiful speech. They began, by the way, by saying, "No one will see us." She ends by saying, "We're in the sight of God." She's really theologically astute, even under pressure. And then she screams, which is the right thing to do under Mosaic law. It lets people know this is not your choice. The servants rush in. She's falsely accused. According to Mosaic law, two witnesses are required to give evidence for a capital offense. And there's no way a single person can refute two witnesses. This was a rigged trial. She was condemned to death, and immediately she then prays, "O eternal God, who knowest hidden things, who knowest all things before they happen, thou knowest I am innocent of what they have maliciously fabricated against me, and yet I must die." And at once the Lord heard her. That's what the scripture says. Inspired Daniel, who cries out, "I'm innocent of the blood of this one." The people say, "Well, let's go back to trial." Daniel says, "Separate these two men," calls over one and says, "Okay, under what tree did you see this happen?" And he names one tree. The other one names a different tree. Perjury proven. The people then do to him, according to Mosaic law, what would have happened to her. The penalty for perjury is to suffer exactly what the perjurer would have caused to have happen to the innocent party, which is stoning to death. So the men were executed. And the people rejoiced, because the Lord had saved innocent blood in the day and that day, the Lord who saves those who trust in him. So that's a great and powerful account. Now, Marina Warner briefly refers to this as Susanna demure before the aged voyeurs. Well, now, demure, that's not based on the biblical account. She's been looking at Renaissance paintings of Susanna, which have altered the story quite a bit. This is more 18th century painting stuff. This is not the scripture. Before the aged voyeurs, doesn't sound like she's in danger of losing her life here, does it? The whole tone of this is unfair. Okay, now we get to, the church fathers saw a forerunner of the Christian virgin in her. Well, now I'm doing a book on Susanna, and I've read over 1,200 texts about her, and I can tell you that no, they didn't. The first person who ever compares Susanna to a virgin is a 12th century monk who's writing a treatise for celibate nuns, and he's offering her as a model for them. What you have in the Church Fathers repeatedly is giving a balance of examples a number of times in Greek and in Latin texts and sermons. You'll have male and female, Susanna and Joseph, who resisted Potiphar's wife, would be examples of chastity, for instance. Or you might have virgin and married woman and widow, and virgin and married man and elderly man. You might have a whole group of six examples. But you never had Susanna shown as a virgin because she was a wife. Scripture tells us she had children. It's not until the Renaissance when you began to get people who took her clothes off for the paintings and thought it'd be more fun if she was an adolescent, wouldn't it? And that's where the notion of Susanna as a virgin comes in. You don't get that in the Bible or in the early church. So here in a single sentence with no footnotes, we still have misrepresentation in a way that slides by you if you're not questioning things. Now, a lot has been written about Susanna. I'm going to choose a number of examples from this just to show further. We have in the scripture that statement. The old man saw her going into the garden every day and walking, and they were inflamed with lust toward her. And they perverted their own mind and turned away their eyes that they might not look unto heaven nor remember just judgments. That's pretty clear. And you have a number of good discussions, including by Albert the Great, on the psychology of this and how what the old men have done to themselves to mess themselves up. However, in the 1990s, you have a number of feminist biblical scholars who treat Susanna in a quite different way and claim to be basing it on the biblical text. In the Journal of the Study of the Old Testament, Jennifer Glancy has this article saying that when the elders see Susanna, they metaphorically avert their eyes from heaven. The text suggests that looking at a beautiful woman renders a man unfit to look at heaven. Well, if she hadn't suppressed that verse, they perverted their own mind, if she'd brought that out and mentioned that, it would be clear that the text is putting the blame right where it belongs. And she's not the only one. Mieke Ball does something very similar about the same time, influential Dutch biblical scholar who does a lot with art history. And Alice Bach, in an article entitled Susanna in Her Own Words, does not quote Susanna's own words, but ends up making statements similar to what Bach, Glancy and Ball and others make. So there are a variety of ways that you can have what I've called generally vanishing footnotes, but specifically it's just a lack of complete evidence. And sometimes the lack of evidence allows a manipulation of what's going on. Very briefly, for the smoke of ideology, consider just the tone of the statement, demure before the voyeurs. Sometimes the tone is affecting the transmission, honestly, of the content. And political correctness often slants things. A specific strand of political correctness, radical feminism, not natural justice feminism, like Louise May Alcott and Dorothy L. Sayers, not new feminism, but the type of feminism that posits that men are inferior categorically, that men must be guilty in this passage, and they must have made Susanna feel guilty. That's often the cause of some of that cloud. For smoke and mirrors, I think of the mirrors of self-projection. And that article by Madeline Pettit on Tamar, I think she was just sure that the evangelists were guilty of suppressing something positive. And even if she couldn't find evidence that it was there, it must have been there. And the only reason you can't find it is because it's been so suppressed. And that's just not a legitimate way of proceeding. If that's what she thought, she should have stated that and then indicated how we might look to retrieve the evidence. And finally, sawing the woman in half. You know how that trick works, where it seems like a woman, well, a woman does get into a box and her head sticks out one end and feet come out the other end and they seem to be those of the same woman. The lid is put down and the magician saws through and slides the two parts apart with the head over here and the feet over there and then puts them back together and opens it up and the woman gets out again and she's whole. In fact, of course, what's happened is that there was another woman hidden inside the whole time, scrunched down at one end, and the first woman scrunched up at another end. I use this image because it's a nice way of fixing a nice metaphor for no matter how incisive and trenchant and cutting the remarks may seem, if there's been chicanery, they never come close to the body of evidence. That there's been some moving around, some shifting, that's not been made apparent to the one watching it. Does all this mean we should have no trust in scholarship? Of course not. Does it mean we should be prudent when we read it? Yes. Does it mean we should be prudent when we perform it? Yes. Scholarship begins with an encounter with reality, and we proceed by coming up with a working hypothesis for the evidence we see, and testing to see how that fits all the evidence, looking to see what others have said and how that reinforces or challenges or corrects something we're saying. And then when we get very close to the end of the work, we need to say, if I am wrong, what evidence might exist? And look for that evidence. And I want to go back to Dorothy L. Sayers here, because interestingly, she has a number of her novels treat that very theme. In Clouds of Witness, she has Lord Peter's brother accused of murder, and he finds out, to his shock, that his sister is apparently concealing evidence about it, and a friend who's a police detective is appalled to it and doesn't really want to pursue the matter. And Peter says, the best thing we can do is look the evidence in the face, no matter how ugly. And I don't mind admitting it, some of it's a perfect gargoyle. And later on, in another novel, it looks like a friend of his and his new wife, Harriet Vane, Harriet Whimsey by that time, may be guilty of murder. And Harriet says, but we don't have proof. And Peter says, evidence. We have evidence, and we must follow the evidence no matter what. The truth is all that matters. I'd like to offer one encouraging example. In my own scholarship, when I was working on Susanna as a type of Christ, I found not just one text, but the whole series of early Christian texts that presented her in that way, and suddenly realized, it looks like I have a mainstream Christian tradition because Augustine, Jerome, and Ambrose, and Maximus of Turin all talk about her as a type of Christ. Okay, if I'm wrong, if it wasn't a mainstream tradition, or rather, it was because we have all those texts, let's say that it was a contested tradition, that some people didn't like it. What would I expect to find? Manuscripts where the passages had been deleted. New manuscripts that had not copied that passage or had altered it so it didn't have the same typology. In a collection of sermons, I would expect the sermons that treat this typology not to be copied as often. So I looked. I looked in all the critical editions because that'll tell you, if, you know, this part is not in this manuscript or this is in so many manuscripts. And I found out that there are no cases of suppression of the text about Susanna. And in fact, for Maximus of Turin, it proves to be that the two sermons he preached on Susanna during Holy Week were his most popular. There are only two or three other sermons that are in as many manuscripts as that pair of manuscripts. So looking for the truth wherever it goes, even when you think it's going to be an ugly gargoyle, may end up actually presenting something more beautiful than you'd expected. So I just exhort you to rejoice in the honor of the wine, as I'm sure you do. Thank you.
We have a friendly fellowship between Gonzaga University and Whitworth University that goes back some years. And one of the point people involved in that is Dr. Dale Soden, who is currently the assistant to the president and the director of the Weyerhaeuser Center for Christian Faith and Learning, in addition to being a history professor at Whitworth University. And we have the honor of having Dr. Soden here today, who's going to offer us some comment before our discussion. Dale, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, David. Thank you, Catherine. Very much it's a pleasure to be here. And again, I've had a great relationship with many Gonzaga faculty over the years, including Michael and Catherine and David and Brian Clayton, and we're working with Margaret Rankin here, and Bob Turker's a good friend, and so it's a pleasure to be here. And where did Chris go? Chris was on our campus and gave an award-winning paper on Dark Knight as part of the Faith, Philosophy, and Film Conference earlier in the semester. And I'm sorry to say, at one level, it was the best paper of the three. The other two Whitworth papers were good, but I thought Chris's was just first rate. So again, thanks for having me. And this is a great tradition, neat tradition that you all have here. As Catherine was speaking, I was thinking of a couple of stories about intellectual integrity, scholarly integrity in the field of history, and perhaps some of you have heard of these, but it just really is to reinforce some of her points here. But you may know the name Doris Kearns Goodwin, and she has written a book that's gotten a lot of play and press recently, and that's called Team of Rivals. As Barack Obama begins to put his cabinet together, and there have been a lot of comparisons to Abraham Lincoln, and she wrote this study book on the Lincoln cabinet and how he, Lincoln, put together this team of rivals. Anyone read that book? Well, if you pick it up, go to the footnotes, because you'll see page after page, you can barely read them because there's so many footnotes in there that they put them into an exceedingly small print. But the reason that she did it was that her scholarly career was in serious jeopardy prior to this book, because she was not careful about her footnotes, and she was accused of plagiarism in earlier work. And it pretty much destroyed her career until she wrote this more recent book. And in order to prove her credibility, she again basically hit the document virtually every paragraph that she had in the book. Well, another story that may or may not have heard got some national press is not so much a scholarship issue as a teaching issue in terms of integrity. There's a professor of history at Mount Holyoke College. My daughter happened to go there, and so I was probably a little bit more alert to what was going on at the time. But his name is Joe Ellis, and Joe Ellis has written a number of books on, largely speaking, the American Enlightenment, the Founding Fathers. Perhaps his most well-known book is Founding Brothers. If you go into virtually any airport, go into the history section, you can find several Joe Ellis books. So he's a very widely published professor of history, a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of history. Well, Joe was a very popular professor, is still a popular professor at Holyoke College, and teaches courses primarily in American history, as you would suspect, and he has a course on the Vietnam War and the Ron Large, and I've known for many, many years, is a great, great course here on the Vietnam War. But Joe would teach these courses packed out, and one of the things that students really appreciated was the fact that Joe would describe what it was like to be in Vietnam as a member of, I think, Marines or the infantry, I can't remember which now, but he would, at an appropriate point, describe his tour of duty, and as you can imagine, this riveted students, and people like to hear his stories, his this professor who was there. Well, he would do this for several years, till at one point someone was listening and they started hearing something that they either knew enough about Joe's life or something that didn't quite square with what they believed the truth of Joe's story as they knew it, and they started investigating a little bit, and the Boston Globe got involved, and sure enough, they discovered that Joe had never served in Vietnam. So an issue of intellectual integrity, not so much scholarly integrity in that sense. And Joe was suspended, I believe, long enough to write another book. But in any event, maybe that was enough said, or he got it. But I have one other intersection with the story that was kind of personally interesting. I too teach a course on the history of Vietnam, and we lost a student a couple of years ago in Afghanistan, and he'd been in my class and our magazine. Where today decided to do an issue on how we teach war at Whipple, and I was invited to just write a brief synopsis of how I try to deal with the Vietnam War. And so I got this email from a Whitworth alum, and he had served in Vietnam and then come to Whitworth after his service was over, and he said, I appreciate what you seem to try to do, and so on and so forth, and just briefly describe his service. And then he said, I've actually published a couple of articles in the Wall Street Journal that depicts and describes his own experience. I said, great, can I share these with my class? And he said, no, that'd be fine, but I'd like you to properly attribute them to him. That seemed like a strange request a little bit, so I kind of probe a little bit, and I can't remember all that I asked, but he said, well, what happened at one point earlier was that a professor of another institution used these stories in the Wall Street Journal and used them for his, describe his own experience instead of, attributing them to this person who actually fought in the war. And so I just happened to ask, now this wouldn't be Joe Ellis. and he said, yeah. He sent me the apology from not a little president, I've had this guy come up and talk about us for the last couple of years. But in any event, what Joe did was to read this stuff in the Wall Street Journal and then pretty much use it as his own story in class. And you think about the contract that we as professors have with you as students, and Catherine's will be talking about this contract that we have with the reader and the level of honesty and transparency. But again, in thinking about how people teach and how they try to get you excited, and the fact that we do share our stories, and if those stories lack a certain integrity, I think we do very much violate the kind of contract what we have with you.
Well, again, all that you said triggered that for me, and I so much appreciate your rigorous analysis, really, of what it means to be intellectually honest. Again, I think as I was listening, I also was thinking about critical thinking. There's not a college or university in the country who doesn't lift up the value of the goal of critical thinking in its catalog and saying, that's what we do at Gonzaga. That's what we do at Whitworth. That's what a liberal arts education is all about. And yet, Catherine's close reading and analysis, the kind of evidence that was being used, is a good example of a way in which I probably failed my students in many respects to help them see more clearly what it means to use evidence as carefully as what Catherine was suggesting. What does it mean to suspend a certain judgment? What does it mean to try to understand a bias? All of these elements that we have in the back of our mind, perhaps, as elements of critical thinking, but I'll just speak for myself, probably don't do a very good job of unpacking that for students. We probably do you all a real disservice by not attending to, again, the component parts of of critical thinking. So to again think about categories of data, think about the process of selecting evidence, thinking about counterfactuals that we might employ in order to test our hypothesis or argument, thinking about bias. All of that, you know, I think is great, and again a real challenge to any of us who again think that we're doing a great job of teaching critical thinking. Now, I suspect that all of us are drawn toward this approach, and I can't imagine too many people disagreeing with Catherine's emphasis on this. But I think I want to raise one other issue that Catherine didn't deal with directly and maybe engage her or you around this. And it is the issue of bias and perspective, and what her paper again made me think about is that over the last 10, 15 years now, maybe as much as 20, within certainly the circles that I'm familiar with as far as what we would say the Christian Academy, the issue of objectivity and bias has been a very interesting one, because on the one hand, the Academy has prided itself. I think she has shown how, in these examples at least, the Academy more recently in Catherine's mind has not been very accountable to itself, to its own standards of objectivity, if you will, or careful evidence. Well, one of the either intended and sometimes unintended consequences of the pursuit of objectivity in the 20th century has been, as you probably know, has been at one level the rejection of what we'll say is the Christian perspective as it relates to all sorts of engagement with reality in the culture. I went to the University of Washington and trained as a PhD, and you know, I was to set at the door any Christian perspective. I needed to sort of set aside my own identity or my own worldview, if you want to use that terminology, and enter into the world of historical reading and analysis from theoretically an objective point of view. And at some level, that's what Catherine is asking us to take up the charge and allow wherever the evidence goes, you know, we should follow that with perhaps, from a Christian perspective, the underlying assumption that all truth is God's truth, or some level that's how we would even understand our pursuit as a Christian scholar. The challenge, though, or the difficulty is that, and that's been raised in lots of settings since then, is whether, first of all, it's possible, when you don't have to be a postmodernist, you're going to think, well, that is that really possible or not possible? What level of objectivity can you achieve it? And can you do all of the things that Catherine so rightly suggests? Can you really get to an objective point of view? But I think it's a valid question to ask, and one that quote unquote Christian scholars have been asking themselves. Shouldn't I or we as Christian scholars have an obligation to identify ahead of time or in the preface of the scholarly work that we're writing what our basic worldview is? Is it important as a scholar to identify yourself as a Christian to your reading audience? Is it important to represent yourself as a Jew or a Muslim? Is it important to represent yourself as a Catholic or a Presbyterian or a Lutheran or an Anabaptist or whatever orientation you might have to certain fundamental issues of human nature or even epistemology to a certain extent, let alone metaphysics? How does that work? Probably the person that has pushed this the hardest would be a historian and learner named George Marsden, who in his work on Christian scholarship has made the argument that as Christian scholars it's important to identify one's worldview in just the same way it would be important to identify one or at least allow one's
allow you to read this understanding. If you were a Marxist, for example, and you had a particular orientation to history or class and class conflict in some sense. So I think I'll quit with that and just let everyone else kind of weigh in on this. But the issue of identifying bias as opposed to trying to eliminate all bias, I think is something that scholars continue to wrestle with. And again, I welcome your questions or additional comments to Catherine as well. So thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's the tradition at the Gonzaga Socratic Club to pursue the argument by discussion. So if you have questions for either or both of our speakers, fire away.
Yes. I was kind of wondering how does one deal with sort of the opposite of what you're describing with the person who is sort of less than critical and isn't that no evidence to satisfy. So that you can have someone who casts a perfectly true position in doubt because well, they just keep on chomping the evidence and eventually, you know, if the tape looks extreme, how do you prove to someone who won't have to be proven? How do you do that? Maintain credibility with the audience observing this sort of tape.
So this is really a conversational setting, I take it.
Back and forth.
if there could be truly scholarly blogs, are presumably they're engaged in these activities because they already have a prior commitment to seeking out the truth, coming to some level of intellectual understanding, and so forth. It isn't a matter of so much proselytizing, right, trying to convince other people. People may or may not be convinced and so forth along the way, but the goal here is intellectual achievement of some kind, knowledge. So I would say that would be another element of the sort of problem you raise.
I left out about half of what I had actually written because I didn't want to go on all of it, but there's a wonderful statement about the trivium in medieval schools about how logic teaches and rhetoric colors words. So it's exactly what you're saying, that it's logic that structures the argument and provides the analysis. The role of rhetorical persuasion is to make that easy to understand. That's the proper role, I should say. Some people just substitute that for substance. If you would require certain things from Christine, you would require something for Jerome.
he tests various biases or follows the evidence, or would you assume that there's a tendency, or even an unconscious tendency, to select evidence or shape it in falling into the pitfall that you, I think, so clearly articulated? If it doesn't have to be half, you don't have to cut the woman in half. But if you just cut the woman, you know, in an eighth, or, you know, because you want to stress, you know, the, you know, at some level, a little bit more positive orientation to something that would be more negative because of the way in which you see the world. Is that something that has to happen in the world of transparency? Which is, to me, what you're arguing for. Let's be transparent. And that's, you know, David's point about classroom or whatever. At what level do we become fully transparent?
I don't know that that's necessary. I always thought the way somebody perceived it indicated the person's point of view. That the reader had a job to study that. And in fact, I think a failing in some scholarship since the 70s, like Amy Jo Levine, one of her articles begins with three pages of biography. Where do you get the subject? And whether she intended to or not, she said, I have been put upon. You better believe me. That's just really inappropriate. When the self-disclosure has the danger of distancing oneself from responsibility, ironically. Now, I don't think that's at all what you're talking about. I don't think that's at all what you're saying, what you're describing is something that would be susceptible to that greatly. But it's curious that in an age where it's so easy to find out things about people, that there's also a drive to have more disclosure. In terms of my own scholarship, it depends on the venue in which I'm publishing. I have two pieces on the table there that just came out this week. One is Catholic Biblical Quarterly, and the one is St. Bonaventure's Theological Journal. And I identified myself there as visiting Catholic, because I wanted to be clear that I wasn't pretending to be Orthodox. but that's a special circumstance.
No, that's a good example. You know, I think that's what you're doing is debating a context in which self-disclosure, you know, is more or less important.
Well, there are some cases where a perceptive reader is going to be able to pick up things about you by academic affiliation, by your publishing record. Those are going to be clues anyway. And your argument in part would be that a critical reader has a responsibility to track out and trace out some of those clues and cues that are already out there able to be seen by anyone.
In fact, in some journals, and I think CBQ, if memory serves, as one of them, they take off initials indicating religious affiliation after scholars' names, even when those appear in publications. I have my footnotes. I think that's the journal that they took those things out. So that they were mandating less disclosure than the scholar had used. It's an interesting issue. What do you do in the classroom? Do you think that there is appropriate self-disclosure at the start of a semester?
Well, in the case of the classroom, I would say the problem is you worry about creating an impression on the part of students that they need to in some sense, shape what they do in the classroom to meet what they suppose might be or might see. That's actually an argument against self-disclosure.
I think so.
I just had a quick question. Before that time, if you publish this lecture as an article, I would love to have my critical agents consider it. And also, a wonderful presentation. This summer, I was on a military research project, and I had the opportunity. said that the DOD's, this think tank, did a study of which had more errors, Wikipedia or the Encyclopedia Britannica. And the government's resource, they actually found that Encyclopedia Britannica has more errors. And so the reason why I'm mentioning that is you've taken us through this excellent tour of how scholarship operates in the footnoting process. But when you look at Wikipedia, that's not really part of Wikipedia in the early 2000s and whatnot. But even though Wikipedia is more accurate than many scholarly articles, I was wondering what reply should I give my students as to why the process of scholarship that you've taken us through is more beneficial than Wikipedia, even though Wikipedia is more accurate.
Well, this is Wikipedia parasitic on scholarship, though.
Yeah.
So I think that that's sort of like saying, why do we need cows when we get milk at the grocery store?
It's the bovine approach to scholarship.
Thinking about that.
Maybe not too long. But I think it is. It's parasitic upon scholarship.
And Wikipedia is information without a perspective and without a status questionis or a perspective. And the best education you can get is a presentation that just sets a topic in a larger view and then uses a little rhetoric to propel it forward. I mean, I go to Wikipedia a lot, but it is just information.
And it's not going to be able to correct itself. Well, these scholars who make corrections and say, you know, you were wrong about the date that fellow died. They'll publish that, and then Wikipedia will correct it. That's pretty boring. But the corrections to it, where it is wrong, and we don't know yet if it's wrong. I mean, it is wrong in places, we just don't know enough to know.
I just wanted to add on to all these comments that
whether there were errors on that page, for instance.
and what it was in flux, and when you had such a thing, so maybe Wikipedia doesn't get quite as positive a report.
Yeah, I have to say, Michael, I doubt your source in this case. I mean, I have no doubt that Britannica is full of errors, but of course, I mean, one philosophical question we want to ask here is, how would you define error in this case? I mean, are we only talking about factual information like dates of births and deaths? Are we talking about critical assessments of the value of historical research or... in the bios of great historic figures, how do we know if there's an error there in claims that are made about assessing the influence of Plato's philosophy?
It all depends on how much you trust your government.
Well,
it's probably as accurate as the numbers that Fed gives us.
I don't think Wikipedia bears too much more talk, but Nature, the science review, also did a study in which they found Wikipedia to be more accurate than the Encyclopedia Britannica online. So you can actually look that one up. It's on their website. And there's like a response from Britannica on there. And
a
little battle they had.
We shouldn't try and defend the current Britannica. It doesn't deserve a lot.
Well, I agree with you that the subject doesn't bear much more discussion. For that reason, I'd like to return to Dr. Soden's suggested transparency requirement. And it strikes me that that suggestion is a rather dangerous one. And why should we presume bias on the part of people because they're associated with a certain group? And we don't want to inject bias into one's reading of somebody's scholarship. I mean, if I'm reading something written from a Marxist point of view or a Catholic point of view, well, if I'm an astute reader, I'll be able to tell, as you suggested, this guy's a Marxist. He's coming at this from him. I mean, he obviously believes in the class struggle and so on and so forth, and the historical dialectic. But the idea that someone tells me ahead of time that I'm a Marxist, then I'm already predisposed to read this in a certain way, and I'm going to, in a way, it's going to be harder to overcome any kind of bias, indeed a kind of bias is imposed upon my reading of the thing. So I'm very leery about that sort of suggestion. I don't know, have I got it wrong?
I haven't published that much, but I know the uneasiness with which you're talking about. I mean, first of all, I'm trained to identify my own identity, whatever, even if I could figure that out. And what are the core issues, that really do shape my worldview that are pertinent to the particular piece of scholarship, that I'm writing. So I get that. On the other hand, when you say it's dangerous to argue against it in the sense that, well, you leave it up to the critical reader, it seems to me, Michael, you're presuming that the reader does have a sense that each of us, as objective as we really are trying to be, does come at, the subject matter with some matter of perspective.
I would presume that all readers are going to be equally capable in understanding someone's point of view. That's certainly not true.
Yeah.
But presuming you have an astute reader, the point is that why should we shackle that reader with a bias ahead of time? I mean, why can't we allow the reader to read what's written, look at the reasons given, the evidence presented, and make a judgment as to the truth or falsity?
Yeah.
In other words, why do I need to know that this biography of Luther was written by a Luther? Am I supposed to look at this and say, it was written by a Luther? Well, we know where he's coming from.
Well,
and only then seek out non-Lutheran biographies of Luther as what? The less biased or something? I mean, that doesn't strike me as a proper procedure.
Well, let me. I understand what you're saying, and I at the same time, trying to think of a more absurd example that would make the point, though. If you were doing a biography of yourself, and you would call, we would want you to identify it as an autobiography.
know the person. We want to know who wrote, and in this particular case, we would assume that you have a perspective on your own life, and we would treat it as such. When you use the word shackle, I would say that might be the case, but it also might be liberating, you know, in the sense of informative. There is a level of transparency about who is writing. If you're saying that all scholars are equally objective, and that we just leave it to...
Well, I'm certainly not saying that.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, the question is, and that's...
What I'm saying, why should we presume that any given scholar is not capable of objectivity? And that if we don't know... I mean, that we're all... that no one is capable of objectivity, right? I mean, why should we presume that?
Well, yeah. If we're assuming that the reader is astute, we can also assume that the reader isn't going to take one side or the other, and he isn't going to make judgments about the reader's character, and in which case he might as well just not be a student. And so all these things are coming out from his perspective or her perspective. And whether or not the way that they interpret it, we can't really tell. I agree with him in saying that we should have the truth displayed and then let the reader take in for what they want to make that.
I think there's a problem because you're coming from the formation that saying, search your biases at the door, mm-hmm. and the reality that that's an impossibility. And I think what we're asking for is that we all admit, student and scholar, that we come from a certain set of biases because of our formation. We can't help ourselves. We're human beings, and we have things that are innately part of us, that we have our heroes and our... I could be a hero of mm-hmm. And I could, you know, I couldn't, but mm-hmm. I could write a book about him, and I'd like to know. When I read about the author, I always read about the author in the back of the book, and I can tell whether this person is going to be, you know, writing about this person in a positive light or not. Then there's these, you know, Catholic tracts that are out there that are just super anti-Catholic, or like Pete Green, let's say. When I pick up something by Keith Green, I know that this guy is going to be venomously biased against the Catholic faith, and he really has no experience of, and so I just catch that. So I have a kind of a thermometer by which I can say where I'm going to spend my time mm-hmm. on this person's work. For instance, I have a hero. It's Adrian Von Kahn. He says, you know, these scientists that keep telling us that we have to throw out our bias are not really truly biased, not really truly honest with themselves, because if you think about Freud, he says, you know, he doesn't tell us what his presuppositions of the human person are. Mm-hmm. And they're all in the crotch for him. His presuppositions are that we're all motivated by our motives. So what I think what you're saying is really true. There has to be some sort of an admission that we have biases. And I guess it doesn't have to be. I think that naturally that happens. Right? You know, saying I'm a Byzantine Catholic. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. You have some biases because that's what you believe. And
yeah. Well, I think I'm just posing and making the, you know, that at some level, a scholar has a level of responsibility to a certain, and I don't know what that is, Michael. I mean, I do struggle with how to be transparent at some level about who I am, so my reader knows who I am to a certain extent. So, okay, yeah.
Catherine, I'll give you a tip. We're really out of time, so get a last final comment for Catherine.
I do. I would hate to have transparency become a requirement. There are so many politically correct requirements, and there can become a set of things that would be identified as biases. And it wouldn't look at all the biases there are, so you only end up having certain people report certain things, which would just be a way of putting a stigma on them. So I'm suspicious of it. Mm-hmm. I tend to think that the doctor
transparency, we're not talking about putting a full biography. You don't tell people I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not part of it.
No, I do tell them that. I mean, generally.
In a book.
Thank our speakers again.